Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and today my guest is Anna Baccalini-Frank from the University of Pisa in Italy, an associate professor there. Anna, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to be talking about Anna's new article that is open access, available for everybody in Educational Studies and Mathematics, and her article is titled, To Tell a Story, You Need a Protagonist: How Dynamic Interactive Mediators Can Fulfill This Role and Foster Explorative Participation to Mathematical Discourse. And that's in Educational Studies and Mathematics. So Anna, I enjoy thinking about story and narrative and kind of bringing to life mathematical ideas. And I also have done work myself on discourse. So I was excited to read your article, and I'm glad that we've been able to navigate the time zones and have this conversation. Before we get into the article, though, I always like to ask about graduate school experience. So I wonder where you did your doctoral studies and who you worked with there.
Okay, so I was at the University of New Hampshire with Karen Graham. And also there was a partnership that I benefited from with the University of Siena. We kind of opened up that partnership for me. And there in Italy, in Siena, I worked with Maria Alessandra Mariotti. And we worked on conjecture generation in dynamic geometry environments. One other thing I think is interesting and maybe important about those years of my life is that right before starting my PhD and also during the first years of my PhD, I was also working at the Education Development Center in Newton, Massachusetts with Al Cuoco. And we were working on a high school curriculum, and I was on the part of geometry, and it was the first curriculum, they told me, with integrated dynamic geometry and algebra.
Okay, so that leads to my next question, which was going to be, you know, what are the roots of your interest in digital technologies and GeoGebra? And so you're starting to hint at that, but I want you to say a little bit more about what made you interested and why you find value in studying these digital technologies. And then if you could let us know, how do you conceptualize the digital technologies? Like, what's the way that you sort of think about those?
So I learned about dynamic geometry software as an undergraduate at the University of Padova, and I insisted on doing my undergraduate thesis on what they called advanced Euclidean geometry. I used Cabri back then. It was a software, developed by the Laborde, the French couple. It was more used in Italy and in Europe compared to Geometer's Sketchpad, which I used at the Education Development Center, but the idea is very similar. GeoGebra came later, so I did not know about it back then. And now there's also Desmos that I'm going to use in my next project. I really like dynamic geometry as a mathematician because I could generate so many new cases and configurations for the constructions that I was studying. And I used it to test my conjectures. And then I started to learn how to use it to design learning activities for high school students. And I was really, really passionate about geometry. They were always teasing me or laughing about that at EDC. So dynamic geometry basically feels like an extension of me by now. And now I'm more comfortable making figures and talking about them and thinking about them with the software than on paper or on a blackboard. And I use it, of course, in class with my students and now more than ever because of, all the online teaching that we're doing now. So, and basically you need to use functional thinking when you work with a construction in these environments. So, of course, it came as very natural to talk about functions in algebra using GeoGebra, which is the focus of this paper. And in Italy, the main software is now GeoGebra, probably because it's still free for students and it's easy to launch on so many different devices. So that's the first part of your question. And then how do I think about them? How do I conceptualize these tools? Well, I was raised by my advisor, Maria Alessandra Mariotti, to see these tools as artifacts within the theory of semiotic mediation, which is consistent with the French instrumental approach that sees an artifact together with a task as a tool. And in the theory of semiotic mediation, there is also the component of mathematical meanings to mediate. And so you kind of have these three things, the artifact, the task, and the mathematical meanings that determine the semiotic potential, you'd say, of the artifact. So in this theory, the student who engages in a task using an artifact to, produces situated signs, and these have meanings that are context specific. Then the teacher can build on these to move them and make them more general, that move them into mathematical meanings. That's the basic idea, I'd say, or that I take with me from the theory of semiotic mediation. And this is one way I think about the tools. And so it's the way I was kind of raised with. But in the past few years, I have been trying to use a different perspective, at least in some studies, to take a closer look at students' mathematical thinking when these tools are used. And I saw a potential in this respect in Anna Svard's theory of cognition. So I started working in this direction, and I was really lucky to be able to invite Anna Svard to Sapienza University of Rome when I was there in 2016 as an assistant professor. And we discussed together a lot about how to use and maybe stretch her theory to focus more explicitly on learning with these tools. The theory of cognition introduces the notion of visual mediators, and GeoGebra can certainly be used to produce such mediators, but there was more to these things. Some would call them representations, but in cognition, they're someone's realizations of a mathematical object. Anyway, the fact that you can interact with them really makes them more than, say, what you get in paper and pencil. And from a discursive perspective, you might say that you can even engage in a discourse with them. So this is kind of the first idea and way of thinking about them that I developed in those years. And I worked more in this direction with Giulia Lizzarelli and Samuele Antonini. And we published a paper in Digital Experiences in Mathematics Education on students' discourse in the context of dynagraphs, where functions are represented in these one-dimensional things, digital objects, and covariation is the main thing that you perceive and you talk about. So instead of just calling them visual mediators, which would be the way to talk about them in cognition, I talk about them as dynamic and interactive, say visual mediators, and kind of the visual I dropped along the way because it's maybe not as important or not the only aspect of them that is important. And also talking only about dynamic and interactive mediators gives me the opportunity to potentially generalize to things that may not only be visual or visual at all, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great to hear the ideas coming together and how they've evolved and how you've sort of added some additional dimensions to continue investigating this. And in the article in Ed Studies in Mathematics, you're looking at pairs of students who are doing some interaction and working with some of these geometry tools. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, as a mathematician, you make conjectures, you explore them, you know, look at different cases with the digital tools. I really liked how you framed this article because you put forward a conjecture that you had. Like, here's my conjecture about this actual, the data in the study. So I wonder if you could just tell us what your conjecture was for this study about the dynamic interactive mediators and the student's discourse. And then you have this notion of story and a protagonist. So how does that fit into what your conjecture was?
Okay, I'll try to put these pieces together. Basically, I consider people's need to make sense of things. And I put this together with making sense of mathematical objects. And the idea of producing a meaningful narration or telling oneself or others a meaningful story about something comes up also in other studies. So actually, I was inspired by a couple of other studies. And one is by Sinclair and Healy in a paper in the International Journal of Computers for Mathematical Learning when that journal existed, and now it's Digital Experiences in Mathematics Education. And they talk about narrative modes of thinking that students constructed. They show how their students' narratives allowed them to situate mathematical activities in familiar contexts, while at the same time they would express these activities in ways that went beyond the specificities of the story that they were telling right then and there. The reference there was to Brunner, so the idea of narration, story kind of there. And then again, Sinclair, Healy, and Salis in 2009 talk about narrative thinking that can be fostered better by dynamic mathematical representations. being, since they are intrinsically temporal, they yeah. occur over time, right?
You can have more change and dynamism and drama in the story.
Exactly. And to me, this also made me immediately think about the possibility of having more students talk about them in more ways. And that's the other key. So I discussed this with Anna Sfard quite a bit, and she uses too the idea of sense making as constructing a meaningful story. She talks about the three C's, right? A story that is consistent, like without contradictions, that is comprehensive, all aspects need to be considered, and cohesive, the parts are logically linked together. And a story has protagonists, and also a mathematical story has its protagonists, which are abstract mathematical objects. The problem is not all students have constructed abstract mathematical objects in their discourse, and that can be a problem that inhibits them from participating, I will argue, exploratively or participating at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's basically it. Based on my previous research and other people's previous research, it seemed quite reasonable to expect that the DIMMs, so the digital interactive mediators, would provide protagonists for students' meaningful stories in mathematics, because the DIMMs behave coherently with the mathematical objects that they realize.
Mm-hmm. And so one thing we might look for is a student who's doing some mathematics, and one version is they might tell a story where they're kind of the protagonist, like, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to cut this, and then I'm going to calculate this, and then I get my answer. And so it's really like a story about the student performing actions. And then that can contrast with a different sort of story where it's like a story about a parallelogram that is getting stretched, and then that parallelogram has something else, you know, true about it. And so that's one of the differences, right, that would be interesting. To think about, oh, wow, the story has now become an actual story about the mathematics, and it's what's happening, and it's the character.
That's what you want to look at, because you look for these shifts as the mathematical discourse evolves. And so you stop talking about what you do, and you talk more about what the object is and how it relates to other objects. And slowly you also depersonalize it, and the discourse kind of takes you out, or you take yourself out from the discourse eventually. But that's maybe even a later stage than what I'm looking at here, where the objects become the protagonists. And already this step is, I think, key in getting more students to participate.
I'm going to direct listeners to the article. It is open access in Ed Studies Mathematics to get the details of the method and the analysis. But I wonder if you could just give us a really kind of brief nutshell. What do we need to know about the context and the students that are in the study?
Okay, so there are two dyads, I call them two pairs of students, and they're in their third year of an Italian vocational high school. And so they're between the ages of 16 and 17. The DIMMs class from which the focal dyad comes has a teacher who was a participant of my research group and a former student of my mathematics education course when I was teaching at the University of Firenze. He was depressed because his class seemed highly demotivated and quite low achieving after its first year of math with him. So under my guidance and inspired by activities on functions for high school students that were available in one of the textbooks that that I had written with another colleague, he decided to take on a new teaching sequence of activities. So he re-elaborated kind of something that was already there. And he used activities with DIMMs to introduce linear and quadratic relationships, as well as other functions, and to explore them through the manipulations of graphs in GeoGebra. So students would do this by constructing points to drag along the x-axis or the y-axis or the graph itself, and they'd look at the intersections between the graph and lines perpendicular to one of the axes, for example. So yeah, and they'd also look at variations both in the graphical layout and in the algebraic window. So they were used to coordinating these two parts of what you can get from GeoGebra. Yeah, and they had access to GeoGebra all the time. And this was a way that they would talk about the mathematics that they were doing and do the mathematics that they were asked to do. Oh, and the other thing about this class is that I knew what they had done because I had watched videos of the activities, but I had never gone myself into the classroom. So the students didn't know me, but I kind of knew them a little bit. Sorry. One other thing is, why did I choose these two students? Well, because I had my attention, especially on the one that I call Gal, and it's a pseudonym in the study. And he was particularly demotivated and low achieving in his first year. But then when GeoGebra was introduced and this different way of doing mathematics was introduced, he became one of the students who showed the greatest difference in terms of patterns of participation. So that's kind of why I chose them. Then I wanted a background, let's say, class and dyad. And so I had different dyads that I could choose from. And it turns out that, well, they were all from a parallel class taught by a different teacher who had covered the same content, but without going to the computer lab ever, like once I think they went. But it turns out, and this I learned afterwards, that all the dyads that I was given from that class were the higher achievers because the teacher wanted them to look as good as possible. So that's what we need to know about these students.
Okay. I'm speaking with Anna Baccalini-Frank from the University of Pisa, and I want to get in now to some of what you found. And of course, I think there's more detail, and it's interesting to see the interactions in the article, but... So first, let's start with the background dyad. So the one who were not really the GeoGebra class, but they were nominated by the teacher as actually like some high achieving students from this class. What was it that you saw in the analysis that was a sort of what you characterized as a ritualistic discourse? Can you lay a little bit of that out for us?
Sure. So just to get the terms out in terms of what we mean by ritualistic participation, I refer to the idea of routine, which is a repetition generated pattern of our action. And a routine is made up of a task and a procedure. When a student participates ritualistically, they use memorized routines just for the sake of themselves. And this is really important. So it's the routine for the sake of carrying out the routine. The performer usually doesn't attend to any product of the performance that could possibly later be used independently. So they won't use that product later independently. The students also mainly act with concrete objects, not abstract objects. And they don't have the intention to tell a story about a mathematical object. So it's pretty much mere symbolic manipulation. No new decisions are made. That was another aspect that I used to construct my analytic scheme. And so to capture ritualistic participation, I looked at objects, tasks, agency, and sense making in all of the interviews. And the interview question was a classmate of yours, Nicola, we call them, claims that x squared minus 5x plus 21 is never greater than 5x plus 3. Is this true or false? Just to give you a little bit of context. And so what kinds of things did I look for when I talk about objects? Basically, for this, the background dyad, they immediately wrote out the two expressions separately, and they talked about them in terms of quadratic expressions. They even treated 5x plus 3 as a special case where the coefficient of x squared was 0. And they refer to these objects implicitly with saying it or they, so without saying quadratic expression, for example. And even later when I push them and I say, okay, but what would you have done with a whole inequality? And I give them the inequality. They talk about internal or external. They don't even say values of X, so it's very implicit. And also the verbs in their sentences are like solve it or them or do the delta or you couldn't factor. So this all suggests that these are just symbols to manipulate. Okay, in terms of tasks, for this dyad, the task seems to be unfamiliar. They don't know what to do. So they go for the delta and so find the X1, X2, but that's not really what the question is. So they end up, and here I can get to the sense making, they end up not knowing what to do with whatever they get, and they seem kind of helpless. They make these statements almost that seem like they're surrendering. No, I don't know. I wouldn't know. Even when I asked them to try to make sense of why they did, I asked them, why did you do that? What does this allow you to answer the question? And they're not able to answer. And in terms of agency, they don't seem to be constructing an endorsed narrative, but just performing procedures that they remembered by heart. They don't propose to do anything different than what would have been offered, you know, in the classroom or in a textbook.
Yeah, they're trying to remember or discern which of the procedures they've been taught they should apply. And then in some cases, they're not sure which one they're supposed to apply. And so they're kind of stuck.
Yeah. And even once they do apply correctly the procedure for solving a quadratic inequality, they don't know what to do with the answers. They say, okay, the internal values of X, and they even identify them, but they're not able to relate them to the initial interview question. So they can't make sense of that question.
So let's go to the contrast. So you have the focal dyad, which is the students that are from the GeoGebra class. So what did you see in the data? And then what was it that made you sort of characterize that as explorative discourse?
Right. So explorative discourse means to construct a meaningful narrative about abstract objects. And you engage in this kind of talk for yourself, and this is a big difference, in order to make sense of a situation, not to please the teacher, or not just to please the teacher, let's say. In terms of agency, you tend to propose, in this case, like I would have been the interviewer, so maybe they were also trying to please me, but it turned very much into making sense for themselves, whereas for the other dyad, it was very much always looking at me to see if I was happy with what they were saying. Right. So in terms of agency, they also propose new actions and outcomes. They kind of invent a new way of proceeding. And that's what I see in the data. And they are talking about mathematical objects. So the main object that comes out, especially when they go into GeoGebra, is function. And they mention that quite a few times. And this also kind of opens their experience with creating graphs and describing characteristics and giving X values and getting the corresponding Y values. That's something that they did know how to do from before, and they're able to make use of it to compare to functions, which isn't something that they had done before in their class. So a lot of nouns, one function, this function, two separate functions, parabola, and even numbers 15, 13. So it's about numbers and functions. They also shift to different realizations. And this didn't happen before, except because within the procedure, the two girls shifted to the little representation of the internal values.
But yeah, I was going to say, when you said they have different realizations, you mean realizations in the cognitive sense, where you mean they actually would create a representation on the in GeoGebra that they were using to make sense of what they were doing.
Exactly. So, for example, and they expect a line when they put in the 5x plus 3, they expect a line to come out, and that's what they see. And they talk about line and parabola. So in this sense, the graph and the algebraic are the main realizations that they're using. And here it's really interesting. So within the objects, we need to talk about the DIMMs here, because while the background dyad didn't use the computer ever,
they had it available, right?
But yes, yes. The focal dyad immediately asked if they could use it. And at first they thought that maybe I didn't want them to use it. So they try to do other things. But then I say, no, you could use it. It's fine. And so they immediately want to do a function. And here it's really interesting, because initially the discourse seems to be with the graphics window in GeoGebra. And actually Gal types in the whole inequality, because they come to the inequality by themselves. And then he presses enter, and he seems to be asking the computer for an answer. Only he is not able, and neither is his classmate, able to make sense of the computer's feedback. Because actually you do see, you know, the screen comes in lines, in like different colors. So you see a blue area, purplish blue, and then the white area, but they're not able to read that as the answer. So here it's interesting because the dim isn't either an unrealized symbol, but it's not a concrete object either. It's kind of a participant in the discourse. So there's this kind of transitional step that I think is really, really interesting here. So anyway, the students are surprised and baffled by the feedback, and they try to bring the discourse back to something more familiar, the familiar graphs that they know how to do. And that's when they propose, let's do two functions, do two separate functions. So to do functions means to type in the expression, and there they do have the correct expectation. So they get the line, they get the parabola, and they start talking about what they can do meaningfully. So the task initially isn't something they know how to answer. It's unfamiliar, but they bring it back to something familiar and become confident with it. That you see that the agency is quite high. They make a lot of independent decisions. They say, should I write it? What if we do? We could do this, could do that. And they're also bonding. That's another aspect that comes up in the cognitive theory. It means they take the outcomes of a procedure of calculating, for example, a function, and they feed it into a new procedure to come up with a new routine that they're inventing right then and there. So that's also quite interesting. And they always seem to be making sense of what they're doing. They don't look at me to see if I'm smiling or happy or sad, you know, about what they're doing. They just keep going, and they're not happy until they come up with a narrative that's complete, cohesive, and consistent. You can see that also in the ifs. They use an if then or because, you see they connect what they're saying logically very well. Yeah.
And the dim was central, you know, it was a central partner in the construction of that narrative that makes sense to them.
Yes, yes, definitely. The objects in the dims allow them to speak and to make sense of the question. They actually maybe go beyond the dims, and they just leave them there on the screen, and they start making gestures about them. So there's a whole part in which they make gestures with a pen and with their hands, and they coordinate these gestures really, really well. So they're not even talking with the dims anymore or interacting with them, but they're using them as props, exactly as mediators of their discourse in a very objectified way.
Mm-hmm. And again, I was just going to underscore that from the teacher's perspective, that dyad was the quote unquote low achieving dyad, or had a history of sort of low achieving sorts of things, whereas the other one was the quote unquote high achieving dyad. So I just wanted to underscore that. But to wrap up the article conversation, I wanted to ask you, like, what ideas are still swirling in your mind, like having done this analysis, you've been working in this area for a while, but what does this really still sort of leave you with? New questions or, you know, new insights or implications?
So there's a part of me that keeps on being really interested in inclusive mathematics education. And what this study brought back to my mind is how maybe many students who have let go and stopped participating in math can actually be brought back. Their interest can be sparked again if we just do a better job teaching and offer them resources that are better for them and that actually might be better for all students or many students because they're so flexible. So I think that we all start off, or at least most of us start off, wanting to make sense of whatever situation we find ourselves in. So in math, this could mean that we initially want to participate in explorative ways. And this kind of flips a cognitive assumption, perhaps. But then education fails these people because in mathematics, unfortunately, many times you succeed when you participate ritualistically. This is a practice that is very, very common. And this is certainly true for tests, if you think about them, where you can pass many, many math tests by completely suspending any sense making. So I think some students may not be able to participate ritualistically altogether, or they may simply not accept to do so.
Or may not be motivated. That might be like, I don't see much value in this ritualistic kind of behavior.
Right. Like, why? Right. Yeah. And so we lose them. And for them, the path from ritualistic to exploratory participation, which is what cognition kind of hints at, that path is blocked. They can't become mathematicians and participate exploratorily going through this ritualistic stage for whatever reason, either because they can't or they don't want to. So, and then we label them, of course, as having a specific learning disorder or something, and that's easier, but it doesn't solve anything, in my opinion. Yeah, so I think that learning to talk about DIMMs is something that can, I use this metaphor of opening doors. It can open doors into mathematical discourse or unlock possibilities, discursive possibilities for students like Gal and I think many others, because it lets them identify the abstract objects that can be the protagonists of their stories and that need to be the protagonists of their stories. And they can use them in meaningful ways even before having, let's say, completely constructed an abstract mathematical object. So I believe that if DIMMs are used appropriately in mathematics education, they can encourage more students to participate exploratively. Mm-hmm. And this relates really closely to the teacher and how we choose to teach. And I think we can really make a huge difference as teachers if we pay a little bit more attention and choose to offer more opportunities to all students. And how we teach makes a huge, huge, huge difference. So this is something I always tell my future teachers, my in-service teachers, anytime we do professional development. Mm-hmm. And one other thing that's on my mind is I'm also very excited to be able to perhaps continue this line of research in a new classroom that is part of a new research center that was funded very recently to me and my colleague Pietro Di Martino. And in this classroom, we have all sorts of digital technology that we'll be able to use with students and observe them from many perspectives and capture gestures, audio, everything, and study this much more in detail with perhaps a few more graduate students that'll help us. So I'm That's excited.
Great. Yeah. And you have me thinking about stories and narratives, and you had a really nice ending to that story. And now you've just like planted the sequel. So I think that's a great place to stop. I do have one final question just for fun. And this is from my friend Aaron Brackenecki back in grad school. We used to ask this to guests that came. But if you weren't in math education, can you imagine like an alternative career, either just for fun or something that you really could legitimately have seen yourself doing?
Yeah, I'd say, well, I kind of had started it, but the answer is as an actress. Oh. I had started studying to become an actress after high school. I wanted to take a year off, and I was at the University of Washington studying drama. And then for various personal reasons, I had to come back to Italy, and my former high school mathematics teacher kind of had already enrolled me in mathematics at the University of Padua. So that quickly ended my acting career and took me into math and math education. So that was my answer to that. I said, okay, but I'm not going to keep doing pure math, even though I was really good at it. But I couldn't see myself as locked up in a room by myself all the time, you know, making conjectures, even though it's fun and proving theorems. I really like thinking about how people think and interacting with people in, let's say, more cognitive ways.
Yeah. Have you kept it alive, though, with certain shows or movies or actors that you like or really appreciate and kept that little spark alive?
I wish I did it more. I mean, I was still in acting classes until a few years ago, and then I went into tango, actually, where I met my husband, and my daughter comes from there. But now with my daughter, she's 8.5 years old, pretty much all that's alive is musicals, a lot of Disney and musicals, and unfortunately, I don't have time for much more than that right now. Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it talking to you, and have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
I want to close by mentioning that our doctoral program in math education is still open to applications for the fall 2021 semester. We have a community here at the University of Missouri of 6 faculty members and about 10 doctoral students working together to study math teaching and learning in K-12 settings and to prepare a future generation of teachers. Our doctoral program has been ranked in the top 5 nationally, and our graduates have gone on to be professors at colleges and universities around the country. Our program is full-time, and it's designed to take 4 years to complete. During those 4 years, we would actually pay you to earn your doctorate. You'd receive a monthly stipend and a health insurance plan, and your tuition would be waived. For your work here, in addition to your graduate courses and an eventual dissertation, you'd also have opportunities to work on our research projects or cooperate with a faculty member in teaching the undergraduate pre-service teachers. So if you've ever thought about getting a doctorate in math education, now might be the time. We are hoping for some additional applications this spring for an August 2021 start date. There's no GRE required to apply. And I should also say that Columbia, Missouri is a wonderful place to live and work. It was ranked in the top 10 nationally by livability.com and by smartasset.com. If you're interested in a PhD in math education, you can find more information at mizzoumathed.org. That's mizzoumathed.org. Or you can email Dr. Corey Webble at webblecm@missouri.edu.